Okay, I'm ready to start. My clock is showing 9. I just want to apologize for what happened at the beginning last week. We seem to have it settled now. We never had that many people who had the audio on, so the way we work it now is that if you want to speak, as opposed to just sending something, especially at the end, sometimes we like to actually converse, you just send a little message at the bottom and the tech support guy will turn on your audio, but until then, you can hear, and if you want, you can be seen, but you can't talk just automatically. Before we begin, I want to say that, because I don't know if it was cut off last week, that this series, not just these two classes, but the entire series, is in celebration of the 80th birthday of Shoshana Weingarten, sponsored by her son, Mayer. Shoshana Weingarten is the granddaughter of Rabbi Uziel. You recognize it's an Ashkenazic name, obviously, but she is indeed, and we're very happy and wish her many more years of happiness with her family and carrying on the legacy of her grandfather. Okay, before we get going, I want to just comment a few more things that we said last class, just to, for those who are new, I usually, when people make comments and I need to check into things or I think of them, I say that at the beginning. First, someone emailed me about other sources relevant to Rav Uziel other than Rav Angel's book and the dissertation I mentioned. Here is another one. It's called Faith at the Crossroads, A Theological Profile of Religious Zionism. It's written by Dov Schwartz. Dov Schwartz, professor at Bar-Ilan University, I think without question the most prolific scholar of Jewish philosophy today, and he has a good deal in there about Rav Uziel. I also, we spoke a bit at the end, Yisrael from Passaic asked me to describe Rav Uziel, and I mentioned how his door was always open for people to come in, and I should stress that why this is important. There was a time, 30 years ago, where if you had a question for, let's say, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the greatest Passaic of the day, you could call him up on the phone. His number was in the phone book. You could, till the day he died, his number was in the phone book. You could go to his door and ring the doorbell, and he would answer it. Things are very different today. You can't go in and see Rabbi Eliashiv or Rabbi Avadi Yosef. They're very much like senators or governors surrounded by handlers who take the places and provide protection, as it were, and you need protection to get in to see them. And it's really a very new phenomenon because the Gedolim of the past were always rabbis of communities, and they had to answer the poor woman's come in with a chicken, those sort of questions. Today we have a phenomenon which is really not something we've had in the past, where certain great sages are completely protected from the people, and they really have no relationship or involvement with the average layperson, and obviously that's going to have impact on their halacha decisions. I also spoke about Ashkenazic works, and Sephardic works in the 19th century, and Arez pointed out correctly that in the Ben Ishchai and there's other sources, you do, various Ashkenazic texts are quoted. Yes, the standard ones, the Nota B'Yehuda, the Chatam Sofer, and you have people like Rav Chaim Palachi and the Sadei Chemed, they quote, they had enormous libraries. But standard Ashkenazic works, responses of the 19th century, are rarely, if ever, found in the typical, if you go to, let's say, the Moroccan Post scheme or the others, they didn't have these works. And certainly in the Ashkenazic lands, it was basically unheard of to cite Sephardic works. They didn't have them. I mentioned at the end Rav Kook and his opposition to women voting and how it was different than the other Ashkenazic authorities just put out placards and said it was forbidden. I'm getting to you, Stanley, but I have to mention it for everyone. The essay, for those who are interested, is found in this book, Ma'amrei Hariya, Essays of Rav Kook. There's actually two essays in there, and he explains, as I mentioned last week, how the role of the woman is not to be out there in the public sphere. This notion of tzniut, of extreme tzniut, carries on till today. Especially those in Israel know what I'm talking about. The Merkaz Harav school, the descendants of Rav Kook, the followers of Tzvi Yehuda Kook, have the highest standards, or I should say the most extreme standards of tzniut than anyone in the Orthodox world, much more than the Haredi world. Just to give you examples, the Haredi women dress fashionably, certainly when they can afford it. They wear makeup. That doesn't happen in the Mayor Kasarov of Cook World. The women don't even wear shadels. They wear these tichels. Haredi women, and this includes Hasidic women, even Satmar women, their skirts go to the knees, and then you can see their calves, and that's the way it's always been done. In the Merkaz world, you should look at the women and the girls, the skirts go all the way down to the ground. And Ritzvi Yehuda Cook famously said that he was asked, well, the Mishnah Berurah says that there's no problem showing the calf for a woman. And Ritzvi Yehuda famously said that that's an unfortunate heter given by the Chafetz Chaim, and that we should try to rise above it, and therefore you have a, it's only in the Gush Emunim, Merkaz Harav type world that there is this stringency on the skirt all the way to the ground. And this follows from Rav Cook's very strong views on Tzniut. You see it with Rabbi Aviner, and it's an important phenomenon. Yes, yeah, we did see pictures of women wearing burqas, although we don't know if those are Haredim or religious Zionists, but I wouldn't call these normal people here. There's no rabbinic authorities behind this. These are, to put it bluntly, crazy or demented women, as far as women had to appear in a beis din for a divorce, and the dayan ordered her to take off her burqa because he says this is not the Jewish way. So I think we're dealing with weird people here, but when you're dealing with the Merkaz Harav world, you're dealing with a real phenomenon of tzniut. Now, Stanley commented about Rav Herzog and his view of women, and I looked into it. It's right here, the proposed constitution for the Jewish state by Rav Herzog, three volumes, and he does discuss women voting, and he shows that halachically there's no problem with women voting or women being elected, and this was written in the 1940s. Obviously, when the state came into being, women were going to be in all these positions, but he wanted to explain halachically how it works that with women or non-Jews in positions of authority. But he does say on page 97 that as far as he's concerned, it would be better if there was no women voting or being elected, but since that's not the case, we should know it's not a halachic matter. This is a reflection of a sentiment that many people in that era had. He's a 60-year-old man when he's writing this in the 1940s. Women had only been voting for, certainly in America, for 40 years. I still remember, maybe it was 25 years ago when I was younger, at my shul in West Orange, when they took a vote to give women the right to vote in my shul, in shul elections, there were people who opposed it. So you have this old-fashioned, I guess, paternalistic approach to women, the need to protect them, whatever it is. And Rav Herzog shared that. But he did say that from the standpoint of halacha, there is no problem. And with that, I will go on. Okay. We ended last class talking about how Rav Uziel thought that there is no problem with women taking public roles, being elected to office, voting, things of that nature. He even says that we can have women dayanim. And he shows that if you look in the Rishonim, the Sefer Chinuch and others speak about, if a woman knows halacha, she can paskin shailas. And if you were in Toronto this weekend, you heard Rabbi Sperber, he's not like these people at this Hannah Henkins place or the others who are so careful that, God forbid, one should think that a woman's poskening. They're very careful to say that women would never do such a thing. They simply tell you what the halacha is, and if they need to get a psak, they then turn to a rabbi. Rabbi Sperber said, on the contrary, that the women that are being trained at the Midrashah, at Bar Ilan, and elsewhere, where they have hundreds and hundreds of women, they're being trained to learn no Torah and even to paskin. And there's no reason. A woman can paskin. Bakshi Doron writes about it, and I think it's very unfortunate that they have this inferiority complex about saying that they can't. And Rabbi Uziel says not just paskin. A woman could be a dayan on a bastin. What's the problem? Well, like I said, this idea that maybe women shouldn't have authority. But anyone you accept upon you to be a dayan, you can accept a hedyot, an average person, you can accept a woman, as long as people are comfortable with it and are willing to accept it, there's no problem whatsoever. He does say, and maybe some women will be a little upset or offended by this, he says, it's not such a great idea, though, because why not? Women are full of rachmanus. They're very merciful. And he says that when you're a dayan, you often have to make strong decisions, and he's concerned, will the women have the koach, the strength to make this? And I think we can say there's plenty of women judges all over the world, America especially. I've never heard that women judges are more apt to let murderers or robbers off more easily than men. In fact, I don't see how having women on it would make it worse in general, even if running places. Maybe if you had more leaders, we wouldn't have so many wars that we've had throughout history. In any event, this doesn't mean that Rav Uziel would support women rabbis if he were alive today or even in his era, because that gets into other issues, sociological issues. However, from a pure halachic standpoint, obviously, if you could be a dayan, you're a rabbi. Every dayan is a rabbi. Not every rabbi is a dayan. And I think everyone today realizes that the reason Orthodoxy does not have women rabbis has nothing to do with Jewish law, but has everything to do with sociology, the slippery slope, where it's going to lead. Because if a woman learns Torah and is qualified to make halachic decisions, there's absolutely nothing wrong with her making those decisions. There's problems if a woman's on the other side of the mechitza, how will she run the service? These are all interesting things, but they don't speak to halacha, and I've not seen anyone since Saul Lieberman to actually argue that there's a halachic problem, and he thought that there was an issue with dayanus, and since a rabbi might be a dayan, then we don't want to get started down that road. But Rav Uziel thinks differently. Getting back to one more point, Blue Greenberg said that she thought she would, this was maybe 30 years ago, that she would see women rabbis in her lifetime, and it is looking more and more like we will see that. Rabbi Ari Sterkovsky has recently ordained a woman. You have the Hartman Institute, and there's other things, so I'm not sure where it's going, but we are certainly moving in that direction, and my prediction would be that the first women rabbis would be specifically for titles for teachers in schools and things, chaplains, not at, in communities, not at synagogues. That would be maybe a little radical, and I would have thought they would have solved this already, because women are discriminated against. If you don't have a rabbinic degree, you can't get the parsonage, which could equal up to $10,000, even more, dollars a year in America, and women, by definition, are not permitted to get that, and women can't be chaplains. They can't have the same rights to go visit the sick in hospitals. I think those will be the first two areas to fall. Synagogues will be a little more problematic. Getting back to the conflict between him and Rav Kook, he often agreed with Rav Kook, and there are times when we know Rav Kook opposed something, and we don't know, or agreed with something, and we don't know what his reasoning was. Perhaps we can see in Rav Uziel what the reasoning is. For example, when the British entered the land of Israel during World War I, they set up a modern court system. They had to revamp the old Ottoman system, which in addition to being entirely corrupt, it was a place where bakshish, bribery and who you knew got you everywhere. They set out to set up a modern system, and they set up a chief rabbinate, and together with the chief rabbinate, they set up a chief rabbinate court system, just like a secular court system. But as a condition for setting up a religious court system, they insisted that there be courts of appeal. Every system of jurisprudence in the world has to have court of appeals. It's vital, because if the lower court makes an error, you need to have a way to appeal it. So the agreement was that they would support such a system, but the rabbis had to agree to it, and the rabbis did agree. Rav Kook and the rest of them agreed to set up a system, and it exists to this day. Yeah, Beit Din Shel Erurim, and the greatest gedolim, the greatest sages that we have, sit on the highest Supreme Court, which reviews lower court decisions. If you have an issue in Mamonot, in Money Matters, or in Ebenezer, you don't go to the highest court, you go to the lower court. And then, just like in America with the Supreme Court, and every other country, it makes its way to the higher court. Well, the problem is that the Talmud mentions nothing about courts of appeal. Where in Jewish history did we ever see such a thing, courts of appeal? And the ultra-Orthodox, or the extreme, whatever you want to call them, the Haredim in those days, although they weren't called Haredim, they were very stringent in opposition to Rav Kook. They said, this is an outrage, this is accepting a non-Jewish idea, we do not have a concept of courts of appeals. As soon as you pick a Beit Din, as soon as the Beit Din rules, that's the end of it. Or I shouldn't even say you pick it, because if there might not be any choice, if the government gives, let's say, rules of marital law to the court system, if you go to that court and they decide, that's the end of it. Rav Uziel put forth the arguments in support, explaining why there is nothing halachically wrong with a court of appeals. Its focus is on an expression in the Talmud which says, Beitin bata beitin lo daiki, which means that one beitin doesn't comment on or doesn't come to criticize or critique or to overrule another beitin. Rav Uziel says that this is not giving a halacha. This is just giving what the general circumstance was. But any society has the right to pass a takana, an ordinance, to set up a system where another beitin of greater scholars will be able to review a lower beitin's ruling. And since the lower batei din all know that their ruling is dependent on it being upheld by the higher beitin, there is agreement from all around that that's the situation. And as long as everyone agrees, if a beitin agrees that their decisions are conditional, that a higher beitin doesn't find an error in them, what possible problem could there be? We do not have in the United States a system of organized batei din. We have various batei din. You have the RCA based din, you have the Agudas Rabbanim, you have a number of Hasidic based dins, but there's no right of appeal. There's just one beit din, and therefore, if the beit din makes an error, as has happened, or a terrible error, or the beis din is corrupt, which unfortunately we have batei din, which are known to be corrupt, there is no way around this because there's no higher court. Having a court of appeals is there to ensure that if the lower court makes an error, it can be brought to the greatest authorities if need be, and that's the system. Rav Uziel's concern about proper functioning of courts, about issues of women, etc., is seen in another example as well. Together with Rav Herzog, he passed a takana. I spoke in the classes on Rav Herzog. We spent a good deal of time on Rav Herzog's takanot, the ordinances, which were joined by Rav Uziel, and why he did this, what gave him the right. I will not repeat that now. I'll just mention one takana we didn't refer to, and that is that the amount of money in the ketubah is to be increased. In general, there is no one text for the ketubah. If you look throughout Jewish history, ketubahs have all sorts of interesting things in them, different texts, different amounts. In fact, when Saul Lieberman proposed the addition to the ketubah as a way to stop the aguna problem, that is, it would be mentioned part of the ketubah, legally enforceable in the court, that the husband would have to go to Beit Din, he was attacked by everyone, including Norman Lamb, who was, we spoke about this, using Orthodox, agrees that there was nothing wrong with what he said. Saul Lieberman commented, I would like anyone to show me where in the Talmud, where in the Shulchan Aruch, where anywhere it says that you can't make additions to the ketubah. And he's absolutely right. Obviously, the ketubah today is only symbolic. We read it, we frame it, yes, we're obligated to have it according to halacha, but the money in there, we don't know what it means. What is it, 1,000, 2,000, 10? We have no clue. It doesn't have any validity. But if you refer to Sog, they looked at it in the currency in their time, and they saw that the amount was a pittance. And the ketubah is supposed to be a form of alimony. Today, when we go to secular courts and they award settlements, we can keep it as a form of symbolism. But in the batei din in Israel, where the ketubah was supposed to be the alimony, that was where the rabbanim were going to decide this matter, obviously you couldn't have a situation where a couple gets divorced and the ketubah is worthless. So we can understand why they would change it. What the real chidush was, and why you needed a takana, was that this meant that even if the individual ketubah wasn't different, that is, if I get married and I just use the standard ketubah, and maybe the money there is only worth $500, the fact that the chief rabbinate made a takana means that my ketubah is overridden, and the amount that I'm obligated to pay my ex-wife is the amount determined by the rabbinate. And that's obviously a very important way of ensuring that everyone, all the women, are protected in matters such as this. He joined Rav Herzog in another takana. We all know, at least I think we do, that when a woman is married and her husband dies, and they have no children, you have to do the yibum ceremony, that is, the levirate marriage. The husband's brother marries her, even if only for a short time, and the idea is to build up his line. However, and if the husband doesn't want to, or the wife doesn't want to, there's a notion called chalitza. It's a ceremony. The husband takes off, the brother takes off his shoe, and the woman spits on the ground. There's a whole ceremony that's done. Already the Talmud has a dispute over the different aspects of it, and the Rishonim discuss which is better. Chalitza, that is, you have a choice. If you can do Chalitza, is that better, or is Yibum better? And it is broke into Ashkenazim versus Sephardim. The Ashkenazic tradition was that since today, people do not have the proper intentions when they're doing Yibum. And in fact, from the Jewish standpoint of Jewish sexual morality, it appears to people that this is immoral. That someone's going to then have sex with a sister-in-law, and that's it for a night or two nights, and then say goodbye, give her a get. So from medieval times, we already have a tradition in the Ashkenazic world that it is that you do chalitza. You don't permit yibum, except in very, very special circumstances. The Sephardic world, however, continue to our own day, our own generation, the 20th century, with yibum. Rav Herzog was joined with Rav Uziel, and they passed a takana, an ordinance, forbidding yibum. Rav Uziel agreed with Rav Herzog, and in today's day and age, the way it's formulated is that people today do not have the right intentions. They're not doing it l'shem shamayim, which means that it doesn't appeal to people's sense of sexual morality today, and therefore, in our day and age, we will only permit chalitza. And that became the law of the land. The chief rabbinate would not permit yibum. So for religious people, you couldn't do yibum anymore. From Rav Avadya Yosef, became chief rabbi in the 1970s, he revoked this, at least from his standpoint, and he began permitting men and women to do yibum. And he, although he is a great admirer and has great respect for Rav Uziel, he has a response in which he says that Rav Uziel basically was, he doesn't say he was forced into it, he says that the Sephardic rabbis, including Rav Uziel, always had an inferiority complex. And therefore they allowed the Ashkenazic authorities to assume hegemony over the rabbinate, and he gives a number of other examples as well, and he says Rav Uziel was always in Rav Herzog's shadow, and he agreed to go along with this and abandon the Sephardic approach. Now, I think Rav Avadya Yosef is incorrect in this. Rav Uziel did not agree to go along with the Ashkenazim because he was in their shadow, because they were more powerful, because he didn't have the strength to branch out on his own. He was convinced, as was the Ashkenazim for so many years, that in today's day and age, look, who does chalitza? It's not just Gedolei Yisrael who have to do chalitza yibum. It's not just great tzaddikim. It's average people. It's non-religious people. Everyone is obligated to do the yibum if that's their situation. And in today's day and age, this is an unacceptable thing. Rabbi Weinberg even wrote that for modern rabbis to suggest yibum to contemporary people, to people who live in the modern world, you would have to be insane. They would think it's a violation of Jewish sexual morality. And that is what is driving Rav Uziel, not a sense of inferiority. We spoke in the talks that I gave on Rav Avadya Yosef about he overturned many of these takanot and things that the Sephardic rabbis agreed. And some of them I agree, he's 100% correct. For example, when he became chief rabbi, you might recall I told you that he got rid of the practice whereby Sephardim could not get married in the 3 weeks. That is because the Sephardic practice is only from the 9 days. So I understand. Why should, and that's an example of where the Sephardim gave in. Why should a Sephardi not get married before the 9 days if that's their tradition? Because this is just a custom. But when it comes to something like Yibum, where Rav Herzog and Rav Uziel, they explain in their takana the reasoning, I think it is not just far-fetched, I think it's very inaccurate and unfair to Rav Uziel to state that what was obviously a well-thought-out view, that in today's day and age, levirate marriage just doesn't work, just like child marriage doesn't work, and a load of other things, I think it is incorrect, and it places Rav Uziel in a bad light. Very interesting. I heard a lot this weekend in Toronto. I had no idea that Rabbi Price was so friendly and so close with Lieberman. I heard from many people this weekend about that, and I even heard, I believe it was from Rav Hirschsprung's son-in-law, Dr. Judah, I forgot his last name, or maybe that is his last name, that Lieberman asked Rabbi Price to come to the seminary, and Rabbi Price refused. I have a whole list now of Godolim, Rav Hirschsprung, Rav Leiter, Diane Grunfeld. Basically, Lieberman was trying to get anyone of stature to come to the seminary, because as Lieberman wrote in one of the letters I published, since the seminary is an institution that accepts the Shulchan Aruch, at least in theory, if we fill the faculty with great Torah scholars, we could keep this as a halachic institution. And other than himself, he was never able to get any gedolim. He asked Rav Epstein of Yeshiva Shari Torah in Queens to come. He asked everyone. He got great Orthodox scholars, Dimitrovsky, Shraga Abramson, but these were not gedolim. These were not Rosh Yeshiva. So, and I, as I said, I heard much about Lieberman and about Rabbi Price this weekend, and that was very interesting. Let me mention another takana that Rav Uziel and Rav Herzog made, which I didn't mention when we spoke of Rav Herzog, which also reflects the changing circumstances. According to Halacha, there's a limit to, 13? I forget the age. Some say even maybe 6 or 7. You know, there's a question, to what age does a father need to support his children? Different societies will have different times. Well, the chief rabbinate raised it to the age of 15. That is, a father is obligated, and if the father gets divorced, doesn't matter, he's obligated to support his children up to the age of 15. Today we might say that it has to be older. Certainly in America, 18 is the standard age, and if the kids go to college, it goes even longer. But in the land of Israel, in the 1940s, they thought 15. This is doing what Batei Din had always done: look at the situation and issue takanot. What's significant about this takana is that people don't need to know about it. It's that the rabbinate makes it, and they are the authorities. Everyone is bound. I don't think the rabbinate has made another takana raising the limit, and I think in Israel they probably themselves, the secular courts, have raised it to age 17 or 18. But Rav Shlomo Duchovsky, who's a very important dayan in the land of Israel, one of the most important dayanim, and he also has training in the academic study of law, so much so that he was asked if he would be a member of the Israeli Supreme Court. And he wanted to be a member of the Supreme Court. There has always been Talmidei Chachamim, beginning with Rav Simcha Asaf. There's been great Talmidei Chachamim on the Supreme Court, and it's important because many of the Supreme Court justices have no notion of Jewish law. They're great legal minds, but they don't know Jewish law, or what's known as Mishpat Ivri. So you need to have great Talmidei Chachamim. He went, however, he's pretty much a Haredi, and he went to Rav Yashiv, and Rav Yashiv told him not to go on the Supreme Court. So he remains in the Batei Din, on the High Court, the Court of Appeals. He has an article in Tehumen in which he shows that secular court decisions and the decisions of the government are binding on the Batei Din as well. And even if these are against Jewish law, that is, even if they make rulings in the areas of inheritance, like he says that on the Batei Din, they've never decided in accordance to strict Jewish law about the inheritance of the men versus women, the things we spoke about there, Herzog, because secular law is binding, and he talks about why it's binding. How can secular law override Jewish law? Everyone involved, that since at the end of the day, the person can always go to the secular courts, there's the Peshara, everyone assumes that the secular court will bind the Beit Din as well. So if those who are interested, it's in Tehumen, I think maybe Tehumen 12. In any event, it's an important article on how we no longer really need Takanot. These Takanot were being done before the State of Israel came into being, some of them, and others in the early years, but today, with the secular legal system, as long as the non-Orthodox sector is going to be issuing laws, ex post facto, they bind the Orthodox world as well. And Rav Moshe Feinstein spoke about that as well with regard to wills, that obviously we should do Jewish wills, but if you don't do a Jewish will, a secular will, even if it's against Jewish law, is binding. The power of the chief rabbinate was only in issues of marriage and divorce. What they wanted and what they hoped for was before the state came into being, Rav Herzog desperately wanted matters of mamonot, matters of Yerusha, to remain also in the chief rabbinate. That's why, and we spoke about this, if you hadn't heard ours, I don't know if you were on for the Rav Herzog talks, that's why it was vital to pass takanot, giving equal inheritance to men and women, because he knew that the non-Orthodox, and even the Orthodox, would never settle for a system in which women were discriminated against, And if they didn't pass these takanot, then areas such as this would be entirely removed from the Beit Din. But the other Dayanim opposed him on this. They didn't believe that they should give in. And what happened was that all these were removed. And today, it's the exact same situation today, where you can go to a secular court. In the days of the British, you could also go to a secular court. But they wanted, with the new state of Israel, Herzog was a dreamer, as we saw. He thought it might be possible to actually have religious law, Choshen Mishpat, govern the state of Israel. It governs it to an extent in that if you want to go to it, you can go to it, but it's not obligatory. And although I might have misunderstood him, I do think that that's what the Archbishop of Canterbury was referring to when he spoke about Sharia law. That is, that if people want to go to it, that it should be, they should be able to. The problem, of course, is that it'll never be voluntary. Women will be forced into it, so voluntarily they'll go to the Sharia courts, but at the end of the day, they're going to be forced to go, and it'll create terrible inequities with them. But in theory, and if you read what the Archbishop said, he compared it to the Jewish Batei Din, in which people voluntarily go to Jewish courts, and then these are considered binding. But with the outcry, I think we know what people are afraid of. Rav Herzog was certainly a great mekiel, a lenient posek. There's no question about it. And as we mentioned last class, in the introduction to the Mishpatei Uziel, the first volume, he takes issue with the Chatam Sofer's view that if something's new, then it's forbidden. However, I think some of you listening right now are not going to be very comfortable with some of the quotes I'm going to mention right now, one in particular, because it goes against our modern mind. We tend to think of modern people as being more attuned to kulot, but you'll see right now why it's a problem. There's one famous case people have written about. He had a dispute with Rav Herzog, and not just in this area, in a number of areas, but it shows itself in one case in particular. There was a married woman who was having an affair. There's no doesn't seem to be any doubt about that, and she got pregnant. The question was, is the child the husband's or the lover's? Now, this isn't just a question of child support, that the husband, if he wants to divorce her, wouldn't have to pay child support. If the child is not the husband's, the child is a mamzer. Now, this is not an unusual case. There have been cases like this going back as long as Jews have lived and as long as we have responsa literature for well over 1,000 years. And every Beis Din, every Rav who's ever had this case has always assumed that we say the child is the child of the father. Because there's a principle in halacha, rov beilot achrei habaal, that the most sexual contact is with the husband, and therefore we assume the child is the husband. And there are questions. Well, let's say the child comes out of a different race or something like that, and they deal with it. Those are considered other. But if it's just a question that the child looks like the same race, that sort of thing, the assumption is that it's the child is the father's, and that's why mamzerut has been avoided in so many tens of thousands of cases. We don't know, but that's the assumption we make. Rav Herzog said that today we can do blood tests, and we can determine if the child is the father or not, and therefore we are obligated to do that, and that's what halacha is in such a case. Okay, Dov, thank you for telling me this. Dov says the sound is cutting out. Just the last second. Dov, how long has the sound been cutting out? Okay. If no one else has it, then maybe it's a bit of a problem just with your... If you're wireless, Dov, that also is a problem. Okay, I'll continue then. Wireless is a problem. Sometimes it comes in and out, so it's always best to be wired. But if anyone else has a problem, certainly send it in. So Rav Herzog said that we do, in a case like this, where the woman is having an affair, we do a blood test, and the blood test determines if the child is a mamzer or not. Now we don't need a blood test. Now we have DNA tests. The blood test is what? I don't know how many, 99-some percent accurate? The DNA test is almost 100%, for all practical purposes, the DNA test is accurate. Rav Uziel was very opposed to Rav Herzog. He says, first of all, this is something new. The rabbis of the Talmud didn't have blood tests. We don't do blood tests. We follow the Talmudic rule. And Rav Uziel said it's not just a matter of halachic procedure that we follow the Talmudic rule. If we adopt Rabbi Herzog's approach, it will lead to disaster because we'll be creating so many more mamzerim. And that's exactly what we don't want to do. Therefore, Chazal gave us a klal, a principle, rov ve'ilot, most sexual relations are with the husband, and that's what we follow. And Rav Herzog's answer to this was, if by doing what I suggest, that is the blood test, we have more mamzerim, so be it. He said it's the only honest approach in modern times. He said that Chazal gave us a klal, a principle of rov. When does this principle of rov majority apply? It only applies in a suffix, when there is a doubt. If a piece of meat falls in with two other pieces of meat, we can eat all three because we have a principle of rov. We go like the majority. However, if we can identify the non-kosher piece of meat, we have to take it out. Therefore, if Herzog says, we have been given new scientific advances in such situations, we cannot rely on Chazal's principle of rov. The principle of rov only was applicable because we did not know. Now that we know, we cannot rely on it. This, I think, is a perfect example of using modern scientific knowledge, and it gives you the answer perhaps you don't want, because maybe you don't want to know if the child is a mamzer. And Rav Herzog is saying that he doesn't want to take into account modern knowledge. He even quotes the Talmud, or maybe it's Rav Unterman who also opposes, where the Talmud says that there are three partners in a man: God, the husband, and the wife. And the wife gives the blood. That is, blood tests are not legitimate because the blood test only tells you the blood from the wife, not from the. And now we know that's not scientifically accurate. Rav Herzog thought that this wasn't even a. This was a midrashic statement. In any event, Rav Uziel is showing that he's not comfortable with modernity in the way that Rav Herzog was. And Rav Uziel did not back down. Rav Avadia Yosef, in his responsum, cites Rav Uziel and agrees with him and completely rejects Rav Herzog. And he even argues that we can't use DNA. Yes, it was said by Tzitz Eliezer, but it's also said by someone else, if I'm not mistaken. Rav Herzog has a letter. He doesn't say who the letter is written to, and if I remember correctly, it's to Rav Unterman. I think he says the same thing. It is said by Rav Uziel. And it's said, if I'm not mistaken, by someone else as well. Thank you. Rav Uziel is another interesting post-it. Maybe we'll have a sessions on him as well. He has a lot of knowledge about modern medicine, but he's very unmodern. Now, we gave some examples of this. He thought that blood tests were unreliable because if someone had a blood transfusion, it could change, and he was given a different type of blood. If he's one type, he's given another type. Rather than it maybe killing him, Tzitz Eliezer writes that it could change his blood type. So these types of psakim are very distressing for modern people. However, I will tell you that modern poskim have used DNA. Rabbi Jachter spoke about this in sessions last year. You can hear it on, if you go to the website and hear the MP3s, the World Trade Center. They identified people. There were women who were agunot, and they identified them using DNA. And as far as I know, even the most extreme right-wing Batei Din had no problem using DNA. We can say, however, and Rabbi Jachter did discuss this, that there is a difference between using DNA to free a woman and using it for issues of mamzerut. The first side wouldn't see a difference. Rabbi Jachter discusses this, and he actually engages in some speculation that is usually associated with us academic types. He points out, not just in his lectures, he has an article on this on the website of the yeshiva he's at. He has like three or four articles on DNA, and in one of the articles he speculates that there is an obvious motivation to approve use of DNA in a case like this Twin Towers, because you're trying to free the woman. But there's an obvious motivation not to want to use DNA in cases of mamzerut. The problem, of course, is that what about consistency? If you're going to use it in one case, how can you all of a sudden say you're never going to use it in issues of marriage? But the way halacha is at present, as far as I can tell from reading the literature, is that Rav Herzog's opinion is not accepted. And that a Beis Din in Israel will never use DNA and will never use blood tests to determine paternity. With the result that you don't have mamzerim being declared whenever a couple is married. But they will use DNA in order to free a woman. Is this inconsistent? It is inconsistent. On the other hand, I think it's a result that, as Rabbi Jachter said, this is the result we want. So how far the results we want can trump consistency, I'll leave that to the post-scheme. But that is the reality out there. Rav Herzog lost that battle, and what can I say? We should not think, though, that Rav Uziel was always a mekil, always lenient. It's not the case. And there is no posek who's always lenient. A posek who's always strict or a posek who's always lenient is not the reliable posek. If you can always predict what the posek's going to do ahead of time, then you're not dealing with an authentic posek. There are poskim, though, who, as a general rule, if you count up their tshuvot, you see they're very lenient. And I mentioned already, this is why Rav Avram Shapiro, how he explained how certain great poskim became great poskim. Because in general, they were lenient. They were great poskim. They know to be who and others. But what makes a great posek? As Rav Moshe Feinstein said in his famous interview, he became a posek because one person asked him a question, he liked what he said, and another, and everyone, they began to like it. Well, a posek who's always machmir is not going to have people coming to ask him shaylas. That's just the way of the world. A posek who is generally lenient will get people to ask him questions, and then they rely on him. They trust him. They're willing to accept his chumras also. That's just the reality. We are not the Catholic Church. Our bishops, we don't have bishops appointed. We choose our gedolim, and we make them the gedolim. And there's an interplay between the people and the gedolim. But every posek, including the great mekilim, have stringencies. But let me give you a few more kuot before I give you some stringencies. Rav Uziel was asked, and it's not just Rav Uziel, this is a Sephardic psak, which is found among other Sephardic poskim. He was asked, I don't know if anyone's here from Brookline now, but I'm sure many of you are there, you have the trolley there. In one direction, up Beacon Street, you pay, you give him a card, show the card. In another direction, it's free. Can you get on the trolley that's free going in one direction on Shabbos, if you're going to shul, let's say, or in New York City? Maybe there's a problem because you have to swipe your card, but if you've ever seen the kids who go on the subway school, they have these cards where you just show the person, you have a pass. Can you go on a bus, a public bus, or a train, a trolley, on Shabbos? We're in Chutzaretz. It has to be Chutzaretz. In other words, it's no different than a Shabbos elevator. It's running, it's making stops that it's making for the non-Jews. There would be a problem if you were the only person standing there and it stopped for you, but on a subway or a train it makes stops. What can you get on them and go to shul on Shabbos? Is there a halachic prohibition? Well, that, Harvey, that shows you how long it's been since I've taken the trolley. I left Brookline in 1995, and every time I come back I have a car. But as you well remember, Harvey, those were the days where you can go on the trolley on Shabbos, and I often wondered what would be the problem getting on. Now, you mentioned contemporary poskim, that's a different phenomenon. Today, we're in with the revival of the Haredi world and the increase of the Chumrah mentality or the turn to right-wing orthodoxy, it's dafka the other thing. But this is a completely new phenomenon. That's because we no longer have lay people. Today, you have communities like B'nai Brak. Everyone is a religious scholar. You could tell them anything you want, and they'll listen. Entire principles in halachic literature, like it's better not to say something that they won't listen to, or every posek was always concerned that the people wouldn't follow what he said, so he had this dialectic. He had to deal with that. Today, however, whatever you say, they're going to listen to. These posting like Rav Yashiv are speaking to yeshiva people. So you don't have the phenomenon spoken about every posek that you have to work with the community. Don't make things too difficult to them. So today you can aspire to a new halachic height that never existed before. But that's a completely new phenomenon. Lay people, the sort of people that existed all over the world until the last 30 years, were regular, everyday people, average people, and they were never looking for chumras. On the contrary, they were looking for religion not to be too difficult to them. And the poskim were looking to make it that way. Okay, about this situation, you are speaking about Rabbi Mark Schneier. I heard that he was going to do that. Rabbi Mark Schneier, I don't know if he asked any psak. I'm going to tell you what Rav Soloveitchik said about this in a few minutes, but Rabbi Mark Schneier is not one of the Gedolia poskim, and I don't think that a pulpit rabbi has the authority to make such a decision, because I think those are one of the issues that it goes out of a pulpit rabbi's authority. But from a pure halachic standpoint, the case can be made, and I'll tell you what Rav Zio says in a minute. I don't know if Lamaisa Mark Schneier is doing it. I know he was interested. But I'm going to give you a case much better than Mark Schneier shuttling a bunch of rich people who don't want to buy a house near the shul. I'm going to give you a case where it's mamish pikuach nefesh of Yiddishkeit, and we'll see what the Rav had to say about this. No, it's not forbidden to use any kind of vehicle on Shabbos at all for pikuach nefesh. It's forbidden to ride. It's forbidden to violate a daraisa if it's not pikuach nefesh. That you can't get in the car. There's all sorts of reasons to violate a darabonon. I was there when a Haredi Rav told the children of a woman who was dying in a hospital to have his driver, a non-Jew, drive them to the hospital. There's all sorts of heterim for people if you're not being driven. And certainly, if the service is going anyway, it's like a Shabbos elevator. It's like a train that's stopping automatically. You getting on doesn't do anything. It doesn't add any weight. It doesn't affect it at all. From a pure halachic standpoint, it's very difficult to find out why this would be forbidden at all. You could argue things. The Chasam Sofer was asked. He thought it was uvda d'chol. He thought it was a weekday pursuit. And you give those sorts of explanations. But when Rav Uziel was asked this, he ruled that it's 100% permissible if you're going to shul. Not if you're going and doing other things, because then it's not considered uvda d'chol. It's not a weekday pursuit. Okay, you're anticipating me, David. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was asked about this. If you go to the Erev blog, it's called Erev Blogspot, or ErevinBlogspot.com, you will find the genius in Erevin who runs that blog discovered this rare Yiddish newspaper. There was always a rumor, Rakevitz's been mentioning it for years, that when he was a kid, he heard this rumor that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan permitted people, like I'm saying, on Shabbos for a good reason, to go on the trains, the elevated trains, and he never knew if it was true. It turns out both me and someone else sent him this thing when it came on the air of Blogspot. This guy found it from the 1890-something Yiddish newspaper. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan indeed gave his heter, but then he retracted it later. He gave the heter on the assumption that the Erev established in the Lower East Side by Rabbi Siegel was a valid Erev, which it maybe was, I don't know. But then another Rav in New York wrote that it wasn't such a valid Erev, and that the people don't need this. So I forget the exact machokas between the two. And based on that, he retracted his heter, but he did give a heter. That is correct. Okay, so here we have Yechiel Pupko ruling it. I don't know. Let me tell you what Rav Uziel and the Rav and Rav Gorin and what the Gedolia Poskim said about this, and then we can speak about the others. You say Marasayan. Marasayan is a problematic thing. Because on the one hand, we do know of a notion of Marasayan. On the other hand, there's a strong halachic principle, and I remember being told this even when I was in high school by Rabbi Teitz, that we can't make our own Marasayans. Can we say that you're forbidden to go? Have you been reading the paper, what happened to this Jew in Belgium? He's claiming they kicked him out of a cafe, a famous cafe, wanted coffee because he was wearing a yarmulke, and they said, get out, Jew. Are you going to say that we can't go into Starbucks? We can't go into a place to get a coffee. Even McDonald's. I took a great Torah scholar into McDonald's to get a soda on the way to Scranton. I mean, are you going to say that we can? A Rebbe I had in Yeshiva told me when he went on vacation, they'd bring their food and they'd go eat in the McDonald's and they'd order Coke. Rav Moshe distinguishes between when you're on a trip, when you're away from where you should be. That's already regarded as it's a v'diavad situation. And he says in an area which is full of Jews, then it could be Marasayan, but certainly a place like Starbucks where everyone knows that they're serving kosher things there, it's not Marasayan, and you walk down the aisle of a supermarket, there's no Marasayan. If it was well known, if it was publicized by the rabbis that on Shabbos that it's permitted if you're going to shul, then you could say there wouldn't be a Marasayan, concern. And again, there are those poskim who say that we can't make our own marasayan zachal, that this Chazal and Rishonim gave us what is marasayan, and we can't establish our own marasayans. And therefore, you've had rabbanim who permitted people to pay, let's say, before Yom Tov, or even Shabbos, to pay for a newspaper and go pick it up at the store on Shabbos. They're restaurants. They're kosher restaurants in which you can pay before Shabbos. And they're open on Shabbos, and you can go eat there on Shabbos. You paid beforehand, and they've ruled that this is not marasayan. In any event, Rav Uziel did not think it was marasayan. He said it was permissible. And he wasn't the only Sephardic Rav. However, in later tshuvot, he retracted that psak. At first he said, it's not a good idea, you have to determine the circumstances, and then he said, don't do it. He saw what it led to. The same concern that people had, I know, in my town and other towns, when there are people who opposed putting up an Erev because they thought people would start playing tennis on Shabbos. Rav Uziel saw that when you permit them to drive to shul, to go on the train to shul, they're going to go everywhere. Just like when the conservative rabbis say that you can go to shul, if there ever was anyone, I don't know if there ever was, but if there ever was anyone who held to the heter that you can drive to shul on Shabbos, but only to shul, it's certainly for that one or two people, hey, you're driving to shul, so you stop off at CVS on the way. These heterim don't work in the real world. And obviously, driving your car is a miracle da raisa. So now let me tell you, though, this was a psak that was short-lived. It was a Sephardic psak. Rav Toledano gave it. There were others in India. The Jews used to be pulled on they call them rickshaws in China. They call them India. They used to go on these. Where you could, they had all sorts of heterim around there. However, I would say that in modern times, even in the days of Rav Uziel, the only people who give those psakim, it's not like Rav Yitzchak Yochanan, was people who were removed from the conservative and reform movement, because poskim who are living in Western Europe, poskim who are living in America, when they saw what was going on with reform and conservative Judaism, even if they thought it's halakhically permissible, they couldn't give that decision. And let me tell you what the Rav Soloveitchik had to say about this very issue. I was speaking, incidentally, not about Second Avodah. I was talking about, like, in Jerusalem, you have certain restaurants that you pay ahead of time, but everyone knows that that they don't do any malachas on Shabbos. But, or take the King David Hotel. You go to the King David Hotel, the food is kosher on Shabbos. Nothing's cooked. However, if you're staying there, you charge it to your room. But the other people, the non-Jews, non-Orthodox, they're paying. They're paying money. The restaurant is open on Shabbos at all these hotels. And money is being changed, but you go there, and the Rabbanim have all said that you can give Ashkacha, because everyone knows that if you're from, you don't have to pay for it, and therefore there's no Marasai. Now, you're speaking about Second Avenue Deli, it's having a Heter Mechira. That's a different situation. That's a restaurant that's Mechal Shabbos, and but they sell it on Shabbos. Whether you believe that a Heter Mechira is good on Shabbos, it's a bad idea. Certainly, all the rabbis of stature believe that in cities like New York, Toronto, Chicago, this is a bad idea. We should not be giving Jews ways out, making life easy for them, because that's not what we do, to give Shabbos violators Jewish Torah money, kosher money. They should let them observe Shabbos. However, if you're in a place like Syracuse, New York, where I was a few months ago, or other places where literally the community needs the restaurant. It's not that the restaurant needs the community. Rabbis have often been forced to do things like this simply because if you don't do it, there literally won't be a kosher restaurant, or there literally won't be a kosher bakery owned by a Jew. But I don't know of anyone who eats in a restaurant like Ben's or Second Avenue Deli. That is, when I say eat, I don't mean go in maybe and grab a packaged item. I'm talking about sitting down and eating the food that's cooked there. Because it's thought to be not reliable. There's no Mashkiach on Shabbos. It's just, there's different standards in New York. But this has nothing to do with the Marasayan thing, because no one's going in there on Shabbos the Chal. I'm talking about restaurants where either you pay ahead of time or in a hotel, you go to a hotel in Jerusalem, where you go to the restaurant, you've all been there, and you see the restaurant is open on Shabbos. But you're not paying. I've never heard anyone say it's Marasayan to eat at a kosher restaurant in any of these hotels, but maybe I haven't been told it. Shiboy Haleket says that you can travel, be pulled along. I don't know the situation. There is a response where he speaks about in Venice, going on those in the canals. There were these public transportation. I don't know what a gondola. Okay. Let me tell you about the Rav. He was asked this question. As I said, this isn't about bringing rich people to shul in the Hamptons. Rabbi Rakefet was really one of the first people to go to teach Torah in the Soviet Union. He was sent by Israel. And the situation was there was one functioning shul. It's the Choral Synagogue in Moscow. And there were Jews who were becoming Balei Tshuva. It was the beginning. And they were living all over Moscow. And they couldn't walk. They couldn't get to the Choral Synagogue. They asked him when he was there to ask Rabbi, as far as they were concerned, this is when the Balei Tshuva movement was Zionist. And they said to ask Rabbi Soloveitchik and ask Rabbi Gorin, could they take the train on Shabbos? The way it was in Moscow was you had a card each month. They have great subway in Moscow. It goes everywhere. And you could sew it into your jacket, and you could simply go through, and you could make your way, and you wouldn't be carrying or anything. And for these people, literally, they'd have no Shabbos otherwise. These were people becoming religious. If ever there was a necessity for traveling to shul on Shabbos, it was a case such as this, where they would come to shul on Shabbos, and they could have eat there, etc. Rakefet called the Rav, and the Rav thought about it, and he said, in today's day and age, and he said he knows the problem, and he feels for them, but in today's day and age, with the conservative movement and everything we're involved with, he said that he cannot give a heter. I mean, maybe today, when the conservative movement is different, we're not threatened, it would be different. I do know that Eretz Chemda, which is an important kollel in Jerusalem, the religious Zionist kollel, they gave the decision, and it was there was a Jewish Week article, I can send anyone the link who's interested, it's in their volume, for a homebound Jew, that is a Jew who can't walk to shul, to have a non-Jew drive him to shul every Shabbos, because it's not even a rabbinic violation, it's vital to his religious life. They said one weekend a month, don't go to shul. But they gave a psak, and this was approved by the big rabbanim at Eretz Chemda, that a Jew who cannot get to shul, and there's no local shul, and you can't have a minyan in his house, a non-Jew can drive him to shul on Shabbos. And remember, this is a case where the non-Jew is actually coming to the house and doing it. But at the most, it's a derabanan, and a derabanan can be waived in the case of Tzio B'Tzibor, things like that. You can see there, tshuva. Rav Gorin was also asked this question, and his answer was the exact same thing. Today, with the conservative movement, we can't give this heter, because of where it'll lead to. Rav Uziel wasn't concerned with the conservative movement. He was living in the land of Israel, or maybe in Salonika when he gave this ruling. It wasn't a consideration. But even he saw that in the end, it led to the train on Shabbos, the trolley to go to shul. They're going to start doing other things. They're going to, these are dangerous heterim. Let me give you a few examples of where he was machmir. Before we get to, I see we won't get to it. We'll get to it at the beginning of next class. Maybe the first 15 minutes we'll still need to finish Rav Uziel, and that's the conversion issue, which is really what's in the news today. But he, too, ruled that you cannot have a wedding in shul. We spoke about this last semester. He didn't mention the Hungarian rabbis or the decree. He just saw that weddings in shul, shul is a makom of kedusha, of holiness. There has to be a certain amount of respect. And it became rowdy. It became wild. And that, to him, was not befitting the dignity of a shul. I'm not sure. Maybe Sephardic shuls, they don't talk. I don't know how it's different in our shuls. We throw candy and kids go wild. But he just thought it wasn't in accordance with the kedusha of the shul. He also took a firm stand against burying people who were cremated in a Jewish cemetery. This was a problem that first began in Germany. What do you do with someone who's cremated? If you look in the Torah, if you look in the Gemara, there doesn't seem to be any prohibition against cremating people, and yet everyone assumed that it was Nivel Amet, it was forbidden. But let's say someone goes ahead and is cremated. We bury Mechalei Shabbos in the cemetery. We bury all sorts of people in the cemetery. Can you bury someone who cremated themselves? And the rabbis took a strong stand against it, seeing it as a denial of the world to come, of Tchias HaMesim. One of the rabbanim who dealt with this, I think it might have been, there's two big volumes that were published on this called Chai Olam. One of them pointed out that today we can't force people, you know, we have plenty of Mechalei Shabbos. I mentioned this, Jerry C. Hoffman said it also, we mentioned last semester. People are violating Shabbos. We can't help that, so what can you do? We're forced to bury them. But to come up with a new crazy thing, to start cremating, there we need to take a stand. Actually, no, Hoffman didn't say that about cremating. Hoffman said it about parents who don't circumcise their kids. But there are other rabbis who said it about cremation. And Rav Uziel said, if someone is so removed from Judaism that they're going to allow their body to be cremated, this person cannot be given a Jewish funeral. This obviously, and cannot be buried in a cemetery. This obviously does not refer to people who were cremated, to the ashes from the Holocaust. Obviously not. In fact, when I was at Brandeis, and I'll conclude with this, if any of you know Brandeis, there's a chapel where we used to daven, and there's a memorial there, a Holocaust memorial, a little memorial. And we were told when we were there that there's ashes from the Holocaust. I don't know if it's true, but we were told this, and I assume it's true, buried underneath that memorial, and there was a tree hanging over it. So we were told that the Kohanim could not come near there because then they'd be going over, becoming metame themselves, making themselves ritually impure. And all the Kohanim stayed away from that little section covered by the tree. But now I see from Rav Uziel's tshuva that this is totally incorrect, that ashes do not cause impurity. Even ashes of someone who's a Russia and cremated themselves, and certainly not ashes of a Holocaust victim. And in this tshuva, he actually tells a Kohen that it's a mitzvah for him to gather the ashes and bring them to burial in Israel. And I see it's already 10, so we'll stop here. When next class, we're going to begin with Rav Uziel, but continue with Rav Uziel about another 10, 15 minutes, and then move on to Rav Unterman. What we need to do is the conversion tshuvot of Rav Uziel, which will take us about 10 minutes, and then I'm going to conclude with another very wild, I think, tshuva. I think you'll find it very strange, and I think by then we'll have a sense of this very great postseik and influence. So if we have questions now, take a few questions or comments. People want to point things out for me to check on during the week.
Thanks. I hope you had a good trip back.
Easy trip. For those who don't know, the Torah in Motion had a wonderful event in Toronto this weekend. It'll all be on their website soon. You can listen to Rabbi Dr. Sperber and his discussions of the women's prayer groups, not women's prayer groups, of women aliyahs. I have to say that I went there, and I even said it in Toronto, being opposed to it and saying I've never been in these minyanim. I can't see myself going. It is hard to listen to him discuss the issue and not come away, if not with sympathy, but with a real understanding. And in general, he's a genius, and he gave very interesting lectures, Malcolm Kellner, Nelson Slifkin. Jake Hellman, as I said a few times over the weekend, is doing things with Torah in Motion that no one in the world is doing, and fortunately us out of Toronto can now take advantage. And just to put on programs like this on the internet, which are free, check out what the other programs, how much they're charging, and we really have to give him a great yashar koach. He puts in so many hours for this, so thank you, Rabbi Kellman. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Have any... here's a question. No, Rav Uziel was never outcast because he was the leader of the Sfardim, and there was great love and respect between them. There wasn't machokas. There was machokas. But gedolim who argue in halacha, you know, they fight over it, but at the end of it, as the Mishnah says, they get up and they're the best of friends. Rav Uziel was actually fortunate in that he wasn't involved with the Ashkenazim. It was Rav Herzog and Rav Kook who were constantly being attacked by the Haredim. The Haredim ignored Rav Uziel. He's not in their community. The Ashkenazim, he wasn't a concern for them. No, yes, the new book on the Brisker Rav. Please, you have the English version. If you look in the book on the Brisker Rav, you will see that all the rabbis, there's one picture that has all the great rabbis, including Rav Uziel and Rav Herzog. They're all called Harav, or Harav Agon. Rav Herzog and Rav Uziel are just called Reish with a little line, which means Reb. So in the picture, they are described in a contemptuous fashion. The Haredim do not give the respect due to either of them, but they never battled against Rav Uziel because Rav Uziel was never the public face of the rabbinate for them. He was for the Sephardic community. In those days, the Sephardim and Ashkenazim were very much separate. It's only when Rav Avadi Yosef arises on the scene that really he becomes a postake for the Ashkenazim as well. Until then, Ashkenazim and Sephardim really lived in their separate worlds. Okay. Uh, not only do they pretend he doesn't exist, they know that the letters in the back of Revelvo's writings are to Rafsovechik. It's a, look, it's a long story. They're pretty extreme. What can I tell you? In my book on Lieberman, I cited the Haredi biography of Rav Chesko Abramsky and how they refer to all the Gedolim as Harav Agon and Rav Soloveitchik. They just call him Harav, and they don't call him Zatzal, Zecher Tzadok Livracha. They call him Zal, Zichrono Livracha. And that is Haredi code. When you don't come call someone Hagaon, and when you don't say Zatzal, you say Zal, or you say Olav HaShalom, Ayin Hey. They'll refer to Rav Kook as Olav HaShalom. That's a way of showing a minimum of respect, but in Haredi code, that means he's not a gadol. A gadol gets the gaon, and it gets the zatzal. And that's just the way it is. What can I, exactly. What can we say? Post the book of Rabbi Zeal. Well, the book, we don't really have a website. There is, Mark Angel has a book devoted completely to Rabbi Uziel. The book I held up today is Dov Schwartz's book, which discusses a number, it's available in Hebrew and English, a number of religious Zionist figures. It has some stuff on Rav Uziel. And then there's a doctoral dissertation, which I could send anyone in Hebrew, which focuses on three great figures and how they dealt with halacha. Rav Herzog, Rav Uziel, and Rav Chiyo Yaakov Weinberg. Of course, I'm thrilled with the Rabbi Weinberg. Here you have another scholar, about 100 pages devoted to Rabbi Weinberg. But these three great figures who, in her mind, it's a woman, Navot is her name, she believes that in terms of modernity, when we entered modernity, with the, that is halachic modernity, with the creation of the State of Israel, the three figures who, from a halachic standpoint, because remember, the Rav was not a posek, he didn't deal with these issues, but who were willing to approach halacha and see if halacha and a modern state could work, they were Rav Herzog, Rav Uziel, and Rabbi Weinberg. And I can send that PDF to anyone who's interested, and but we can't really post it because we don't have the copyright or anything. Sure, Sephardim wrote about Rav Uziel. And he cited all the Sephardic posts he quote Rav Uziel. He cited all the time. He's still one of their gedolim. I'll pass it on. I'll see what he can do. But anyone can email me. I'll give you the information. And when Yisrael Koshkin gets his website of a modern or religious Zionist gedolim up and running the way he wants it to, he can certainly post all this information, all the goodies. We've mentioned a number of books during these series, including a number of unusual and rare things, the attack on the Breuers community, numerous stuff. So if anyone's listening to the previous lectures and wants copies of these things, I'd be happy to send them. Okay. My email, and then I have to run. Okay, there it is. Thank you, everyone. And God willing, we'll see you next week.
You know, Mark, I came late, so I might have missed, but, you know, of course, that Mayor Weingarten, the great-grandson of Rav Uziel, is online with us. Our sponsor for the class, and I want to thank him. I know you did thank him, but I want to thank him, too.
Again, for those who came on late, again, once a great thank you for him in honor of Rav Uziel's granddaughter's 80th birthday, and wish her many more years of continuing this legacy, a joining of Ashkenazi and Sephardi, as we see, which really was Rav Uziel's great dream. He wrote, if you look in his drashot, I mean, this idea of the separatism of Ashkenazi and Sephardi was not something he wanted. He wanted now us to become one people. So we'll talk more next class. Good night, everyone.